You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Jeff Vandermeer is the author of Hummingbird Salamander, the Bourne novels, Bourne, The Strange Bird, and Dead Astronauts, and the Southern Reach series, Annihilation, Authority, and Acceptance. His new novel is Absolution. It's the fourth novel in the Southern Reach series. Thank you for joining me, Jeff.
Well, very great to join you here. I appreciate it.
You know, as I read this book, when I first, you know, just talked right into it, the prose is so amazing, and it does so much work, and it does it with seemingly little effort. Could you talk about developing the prose style for this novel in all three sections, where there's a lot of divergence there?
Yeah, I think, you know, it is interesting to me that Absolution is kind of like one novel, but also three novels in terms of style. And, you know, it's a difficult question to answer in a way, because it came to me so organically. I started writing it July 31st of last year, and I had a final draft on December 31st of 150,000 words. And, you know, I was just kind of like, I'd been thinking about the novel since like 2017. And I like to think a lot about novels now and not put much down. And in this case, I hadn't written anything since a novel since 2021. And so I think that's why it came pouring out. But I had thought about it for a while, and it just poured out in kind of ecstatic vision after ecstatic vision. And so one thing about it is that when the writing is continuous, it's really all there in the first draft, even if you're making revisions. And it's hard to really think about like how you came to the style. But I would say that writing things like Dead Astronauts, my 2019 novel, which had like several different prose styles, helped a lot. And I would just say that I liked the idea of a novel that was structured this way, and it was invigorating to me to be able to write something that was a single novel, but three very vastly different styles. It made it useful because I could like go from one style to the other. If I was stuck on something, I would just go to the other part and write part of it. And each one was equally fascinating to me on some level, in terms of as a puzzle to solve or something to just inhabit and not think.
When you talked about inhabit, that made me think of one of the aspects of this novel I love so much. It doesn't matter where we are, with what character we are, what part we're in, we always really like being there, even if the general upshot of reading the prose or the section itself is extremely disturbing. Talk about creating a novel where the reader really enjoys being in different places with you as the writer, talking in different voices.
Well, I think that the overall idea of it kind of being a cosmic mystery with espionage elements, I think with old Jim present, you know, even when he's not present to some degree in all three parts, helps with that to some degree. I think by the time you get to part three, you're kind of invested in that character because I think he's very relatable. Like, he's somebody who's compromised by systems and still trying to do his best. And I think we're all at this point compromised by very dysfunctional systems, maybe not as dysfunctional as in this novel. But we're all trying to really do our best. But more to the point of the question, I think that reflects just how deeply I was, again, immersed in writing this, to the point of not even remembering writing certain scenes, and just, you know, enjoying it myself, like enjoying returning to the Southern Reach in such an organic way. Because for years I'd resisted, right? Like, I'm not a big fan of Frank Herbert's Townhouses of Dune. so to speak. And I think that the one lesson from the Dune series is that the books get more airless and abstract as they go along. And so it's very, you know, I was also reluctant to try to explore what happens after the third novel in the series, Acceptance, you know, what happens with regard to Area X and the world. And this novel weirdly allowed me to write a prequel and a sequel in a sneaky way, while also including events that are contiguous with some parts of the three books. So all of that was just like deeply exciting to me. And, you know, I think also, you know, you're right to say that I'm in the book because, you know, most of all of my books are disguised autobiography in some way. I'm always bringing in some emotional resonance or something in into a different context, maybe, but something that imbues it with the personal. And maybe I'm the only one who can read the autobiography that's in there. But I think it makes a huge difference to the reader. They feel that to some degree.
You structured the book in three parts. Did you intentionally reach back to your trilogy in doing so?
I did not, but it did strike me after I had like the beginnings of rough drafts of all three, because I started with Dead Town, got fairly far into it, and then the other ones I started to write. So I was writing all three at the same time. It did strike me that there was a similarity to the structure of the three novels. And it was not clear to me at one point, even though I knew it was one story arc, it was not clear to me where they would end lengthwise. Like at one point, I thought there was a possibility I was writing three novels simultaneously, that the length would simply require that they be published separately. You know, it was a straight thought while I wasn't writing. It didn't affect how I wrote the books. But, you know, so I think there is that aspect of it, too, that just feels like a good synergy, and that I feel like readers will enjoy that kind of sensation that they're reading one piece of work, but they're also kind of getting three books in one at the same time.
That is exactly the feel. It's a satisfying reading experience. One thing that struck me is I spend every Saturday morning working on an hour of ambient music for a show called The Dream Journal. And I'm wondering, and so as a result, I hear a lot of interviews with people who talk about dreams and how they come and what they are, et cetera, across the whole spectrum. So I'm wondering, how much of a part do dreams play in your writing? And do you, in fact, keep a dream journal?
I don't keep a dream journal, but they have a huge impact because, and this time it was more like fragments of things in dreams rather than one dream that kind of sparked things. But, you know, both my Ambergris series and Annihilation were sparked by a major dream or nightmare. And the fact is that it's just basically a byproduct of prepping my subconscious, like always rewarding my subconscious by writing down every single idea that I get, so that it knows that I'll do something with it. And then part and parcel of that is simply that sometimes I will go to sleep thinking I want my brain to work on this particular narrative problem while I'm asleep. And then I will have a dream or something that solves it. And in the case of like the Southern Reach, I simply put into my brain over the years, I want to write about Florida in a kind of transformed way. And eventually Annihilation came out. So they're very important to me. And I have to be careful, though, because I don't generally put dream sequences themselves into novels. I did here because it can be too floaty or surreal, given that the prose itself can be surreal at times. But here, I think Old Jim's dreams are really about a battle of wills without giving too much away. And so I did put some kind of like sliding in and out of sleep bits with him that I normally wouldn't.
Oh, Jim is such a great character. And one of the things I think that comes through this book, and it's interesting because on one hand, we're reading this and it's pretty cosmically creepy all the way through. I mean, it's weird and it's disturbing to us as readers. Yeah. It's really fun. And sometimes it's very funny deliberately. And sometimes I think you just use a very dry sense of humor. And that makes me think you had a lot of fun being Jim on the page.
I did have a lot of fun, and I had a lot of fun writing the Cass and Old Jim relationship in the book. You know, kind of a new agent, older agent in the field, kind of like stuck with each other and trying to reinvigorate that so it's not a cliche. And so there's a lot of humor in that that I actually had to cut. I had a first reader, Layla, who was very attuned to that particular part of the book, and she helped me a lot with, like, you know, they wouldn't make this joke in this situation because they're trying to be situationally aware. And she was right. And in a way, chopping out some of the jokes actually made the ones that were left funnier, or the banter between them funnier. But it is very dry at times in that section. You know, it's kind of understated because old Jim's kind of unwillingly pulled into it and kind of distrusts Cass's kind of like flippancy at times. Even though she's probably one of the most serious characters in the entire book. Yeah, so inhabiting old Jim was interesting, and like I love the idea of him, you know, being seen in these different modes, including in Dead Town. He suddenly or slowly appears as actually, oh, this is the person who's moderating our experience of what this story is in the first section. And that to me is a loving tribute to one of my favorite authors, John le Carré, because he did that layering so well, you know.
I have to say that that was I was going to bring up Le Carré because I remember many years ago I went on a binge reading all of his books, finishing up with The Perfect Spy,
One of my favorite novels of all time.
and it I saw the shadow of that hit in this novel. I thought, not so much as an influence, just I guess more of an inspiration, and just the way you layered the characters. Talk about using the tools of the espionage genre in cosmic horror and in popular fiction to just give us a new kind of thrill.
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of done this before a little bit in parts of The Southern Reach and in parts of a novel called Finch in a more noir way there. What I always admired about like Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy is this amazing clarity of layering, of history, of relationships between departments and agents mixed in with the central thing they're pursuing. Or the thing that's happening to them, and getting this deep, rich sense of characterization through that. And that appeals to me because I really think it's important to layer in history to some degree. And in fictional narratives, that's difficult to do well. And so I really love the idea of him being layered into the Dead Town section as an operative, basically going through these archives, and you slowly get his kind of addendums or thoughts to the actual kind of like almost dark fairy tale of an expedition that's unspooling there. And a lot of that is definitely, I don't actually think there's anyone like him. So I don't really read a lot of espionage fiction. I just read and reread John le Carré for the most part. But I always really love too how those books lay bare characterization, because the spies are always trying to find the handle on some other character or some mole or something. So they're really having to delve into characterization to like solve the riddle of the person they're trying to turn or whatever else. And so it's kind of a master class for fiction writers on the surface of deep characterization, just in how the spies kind of like speculate about the people that they interact with.
The characters you create in turn are forced to create other characters as part of the action, as it were.
Yes. Yes, and I did have some fun with the idea of doubling here in a way that's non-fantastical with regard to the character of Cass without giving too much away. And so I really enjoy doing that. And I don't usually have multiple literary influences, but there's a novel by Tana French, I can't remember the name of it now, but in which there's a doubling situation. And it's something that narratologically shouldn't work, and yet somehow it works in that novel. And I've always been fascinated by that. So that was one influence on part two as well, without again giving too much away. I feel like there's spoilers on every page of this novel, so maybe it's not spoilery to mention anything. I don't know.
My inclination is to say as little as possible
Okay.
about the novel itself, just talk around the subjects. the better for the readers who hear this. They can go into the novel informed, but not think, I've already read the damn thing.
Right.
Now, you know, another great writer who is not known as a great writer much, but known of justly famous for other reasons, is Sigmund Freud. And he, I think, you know, he came out of the world of science, but approached it in an almost cosmic religious fashion regarding his concept of the human consciousness. And I think I got fairly far into the novel before I encountered the word uncanny. And I think eventually it was followed up by unheimlich. And it made me think that this is, in a sense, and that all the Southern Reach novels are really Freudian novels. Is that intentional?
I think that they forged their own psychological symbolism. You know, the thing that's interesting there is that some people have brought that up. And of course, it conjures up to me the most broad cliches about Freud and dream imagery and stuff, whereas I understand there's a lot more to him than that. But I haven't actually studied Freud that much because I'm really kind of resistant to my own personal symbols, the things that come to me in dreams, me having a system to like interpret them, because I feel like they need to be interpreted in the novel. So you may be right, but if so, it's simply because Freud, you know, kind of tapped into something. It's not because I've studied Freud, because again, I feel like the symbols and the underlying subtext is, and the psychological reality is more unique if I don't study that kind of stuff, if that makes any sense. But then I feel like they get trapped, you know, my brain would begin to think in terms of the boxes that it encounters, that certain, you know, theorists like Freud put things into.
Well, no, I totally understand that. But my take on Freud is less as a scientist and more as a writer in terms of his ability to just through sheer prose and making stuff up, come to some really interesting conclusions. Whether or not they're real is less important than how they make us feel.
Yeah, and I think that makes sense.
That's what I like about your novels is that, and this is an absolutely perfect example of it. It's a novel in which much of the action is pretty straightforward realism, but by virtue of your perception, is tinged with this cosmic terror and also that a cosmic terror that, and I think this, I never thought about this before about your books, but the cosmic terror is a reflection of the personal terror of our own infinite choices and the way we define ourselves by those choices.
I definitely think that would be correct. I mean, I think the wider point would be that, you know, when readers first encounter my books, especially readers who are not necessarily weird fiction connoisseurs, are transported by the visions, right? Like by the uncanny elements. But the actual way that occurs is through deep examination of character. And it comes out through those character viewpoints. So, you know, I don't set out to write cosmic visions. I set out to write characters who encounter things that are uncanny or that they think are uncanny or that simply the universe is a very strange place to begin with. And that it has both an unending sense of beauty and an unending sense of horror to some degree, depending on how you're looking at it. And I think that this is also reflected in the fact that as the 10th anniversary editions came out of the Southern Reach with the new introductions and everything, readers who had read them initially were reminiscing not about particular uncanny moments, they were reminiscing about characters and character arcs. And so the way in which these ideas are housed and how they come out through the character point of view is really, you know, the thing that I think has succeeded with this series and the rest of it, and it wouldn't otherwise. You know, it's not simply the thing that's happening, the, you know, in front of somebody.
You know, one of the things I love too is to go back to the opening of the novel, is it's almost like we're in a dark room and you're slowly turning up the light as old Jim becomes more present in the prose and in the situation. Talk about that effect. Was that effect something that poured out of you?
It's something, it's the organic way that the story came to me. And then, of course, when it's on the page, you begin to ask yourself, what's the best entry point for the reader? And readers had actually given me a great deal of freedom, in a sense, by being so enthusiastic about the first three books, me knowing, even on a subconscious level, that there were a lot of readers out there who would probably pick up Absolution because it's the fourth book in a series. And I think that gave me permission to do that effect. In other words, if it was a standalone novel, I would have seriously given some thought to providing some additional context or wider viewpoint at the beginning. And in fact, I did try writing a prologue to kind of give more of a sense of everything that's going on, and it just did not work at all. You know, this was just simply going to be a novel where, you know, you're on this journey, and the lens does widen, and it widens, and it widens. But at first, it's just this tiny dot, and you're seeing what's in the dot, and it keeps getting larger. And hopefully, you're surprised as you see what the entire landscape holds. And that's the kind of novel I like to read. Like, I don't think you should be given everything all at once. And I do believe that every word of a novel counts. So there's a lot of stuff in here, too, that's meant for a reread. That's not necessarily meant for the first read, but a lot of like stuff that harkens back to the first three books, a lot of things that do give solutions to mysteries, but you do have to read it. In this day and age, I do sometimes worry that our fragmented reading is such that that I'm kind of lucky it's in three parts like this, like it's three novels in one, because that allows readers to have that kind of break and come back into it and really absorb all of it.
Well, when you talked about reading, I think that's one of the things that your books are consummate books for readers that make use of prose. They never read like scripts for things that are going to be made into a movie. You don't think about them as action. The best way to experience Jeff Vandermeer is to read it word by word.
Yeah, no, and again, I've been incredibly lucky with this series, which is basically about the unknowability of the universe, and therefore there can never be the kind of closure that you find in certain books and series. But then also, I think, pursuant to your point, in a way, it's been very heartening that readers have basically completed the story in their imaginations. The number of people debating online about what the solution to the mysteries of Area X are, what might have happened after acceptance, and their willingness to complete it themselves. I mean, you always want to leave a space for the reader's imagination, but here they've met me like farther than halfway. And that's really been, I think, also, again, like a reflection of like how invested they are in the characters, you know, like the psychologist who turns out to be so completely different than you imagine from Annihilation. So,
you know, one of the things that I thought about this novel that really struck me was that the storytelling and narrative arcs were so interesting and so nicely intertwined. It's a really, I think, inventive narrative in terms of the way you choose to tell this story. Talk, and I think this has to do with the way you conceived it, which is to say, you didn't write down notes, you didn't outline it, you didn't write little sub-stories. You kind of, I think the analogy I would use is like you wait till there's enough water in the cloud in your brain that is that book, and then you start to just let it channel it down as rains words on the page. Mm-hmm. So talk about how that form of conceiving the novel influences the narrative arc of the story itself?
Well, it's interesting because it's basically that you have three spirals spiraling towards their conclusion in three parts, and then you have a wider spiral that has to enclose all three of them. And I think, you know, the containment of the structure helped a lot. Like, I think a lot about, like, the structure before it, right? Because sometimes it allows what you're talking about to just, like, spontaneously put it in there. But it's almost like you've created a, this is a bad analogy, but like a cake mold, and you're pouring into it. So it can't break contain. It can't be unformed because it's formed by the structure you've chosen. And like, for example, with part one, the expedition that's 20 years before Area X and, you know, is heavily, you know, infiltrated by Central and has impacts on Area X later. You know, that was just an unspooling fatalism to that. You kind of know that things are going to go wrong from the very beginning. And that really helped in terms of like, oh, this is just going to be basically a very kind of cold, an analytical, you know, because old Jim's trying to like piece things together, account of this expedition. And the horror is going to be in what happens, not necessarily in the way that the prose is. So that helped a lot. And then with part three, Lowry, as the narrator of part, or basically the viewpoint character of the first expedition into Area X, once, you know, I wasn't even sure I was going to write that. And then I realized, oh, Lowry is high on anti-anxiety drugs that are experimental. He says the F-bomb a lot when he's under the influence, which means we can't trust him as much when he's using the F-bomb. When he's not, he's pretty much very trustworthy in what he's seeing, which is an interesting effect going into Area X. And he's unintentionally funny. Like, as soon as I walked into this strange aquarium room at this weird aquarium in Panacea, Florida, which has all these jars of dead things, I realized, oh, Larry's going to propose to, or basically give kind of like a promise ring to the woman he's dating, so to speak, in a room full of jars of dead things, because he's so clueless about ambiance and stuff. And once I saw that, I realized, oh, you know, there's going to be some stuff about toxic masculinity, but he's also just kind of earnestly clueless. He has some redeeming qualities that will create kind of a different paradigm with the reader, which is to say that he will always take action. Like on the expedition, he's the only one who always takes action. So there's at least that going for him. He doesn't get frozen in an emergency. But once I realized all of this, that just came out on the page. Like, I tinkered a little bit with things being carried forward from the first two sections in terms of resolutions to certain mysteries. But other than that, it's pretty much what I wrote in a first draft, because it required that kind of unhinged, just like getting it on the page, because that's who the character was. Sorry, go ahead.
No, well, it struck me that it's been noted in, as by you just now, Lowry is a very profane man in the way he speaks, but also to talk about, you know, being profane is more than just swearing. And I think that he fulfills the larger vision of profane.
Yeah, no, because he is the one who experiences the most ecstatic vision, so to speak. He's the one who finds the key to things by being out there on the extremes, if that's what you're talking about. But then also, it's weird because his hyperkinetic point of view, connected also with the swearing, allowed me to get to some really transgressive places in that section that I wouldn't have been able to get to otherwise. If they'd just been played straight and without a sense of black humor, they wouldn't have worked at all. So it was an interesting experiment for me that I think registers just as like this amazing like narrative surge for the reader in how Lowry acts. I mean, very key to it is his early rant about how he can't eat any of the wildlife because they've been told not to in case they've been contaminated by Area X. And the things he wants to eat just continues to proliferate throughout the entire thing until it becomes something pretty bad that I don't know if I want to get into. But there's something about that, like, narrative surge that's actually influenced by two totally different pieces of fiction. Amos Tuituola's The Wine Drunk, the Palm Wine Drinker, and then Martin Amis's Money, both of which do this kind of thing of like what I would call like as a like acrobat's trick, you know, spinning more plates every chapter, and then more plates, and then more plates, and then seeing just what they can get away with. And I've always been in awe from a narrative point of view of both of them, because they just keep getting away with it, and they get away with it to the end of the novel. And they just become these absurd, phantasmagorical masterpieces as a result. And so that was very much on my mind with Lowry.
Well, here's a part of the novel where fun becomes an essential part of it. So talk about just, I can tell as I read that you are just having too much fun.
Yes.
And I think it comes out for the reader too. That's a really important part of the writing process.
Yeah, no, it is. And it's weird because there are actually very serious underpinnings of that. Like, for example, I read a whole book about UN encampments around the world and their underlying philosophy before I wrote the base camp parts of Lowry. But I knew that anything filtered through Lowry wouldn't read like research at all. So actually, in actual fact, though, that's the only part that I now remember. I cut a couple pages of Lowry's rants about base camp because they needed to get moving, you know. But yeah, no, I had so much fun. Like, I had fun in different ways on all three. Like, there was something fun about what I would consider an old school weird tale aspect to part one that I really liked. I love just doing this thing with this rogue coming into the picture and just like destabilizing their entire expedition. And then I loved just this headlong rush of inventive F-bombs, other curse words. There's one section where you're just reduced to the most ridiculous curses and anatomically impossible situations in his curses as he goes into Area X. And even there were things that were fun because I like to do what I call transpositions in a sense. So they go across the border, but it's more interesting to have him remember a conversation with Whitby about a chicken being experimentally sent across the border than to describe that passage, right? So there's a lot of things like that too. And then things that Lowry doesn't know, like there's an infamous barrel scene in part two, and I cackled a lot in having Jack, the handler for Lowry in part three, call Lowry a barrel boy, and Lowry have no idea whether that was a compliment or not. And of course, readers know by then what Jack's saying, what his opinion of Lowry is. So there's a lot of things in there. And then Lowry's paranoia and claustrophobia about wearing a suit across the border, which I had a lot of fun with. But my absolute favorite thing is, and I did check this in terms of like women's clothing, is there's certain kinds of very put together like business suits where the pants on women at the back form a little tiny bit of a V, potentially, at the waistline. And so there's a thing where Lowry's anecdotally received information that one of the other characters, who's actually fairly major in the first three, just escaped the border coming down by that V. Like it cut the back of her pants off just at that point, and she just got across the border that way. And whether it's true or not, it's kind of indicative of Lowry's section, because it's just a story he's been told that's absurd. And if I were to do that as like a straight on scene, it wouldn't make any sense. But in the Lowry section, in that context, it actually kind of gives you a visceral idea of like this border coming down, you know?
Well, that's, I think, and Dick works through the whole narrative. It's a lot of fun to see how he, you know, as a reader, it's fun to see you just using prose differently in the different sections to create different effects. And so talk about, you know, word choice. If you were writing these all three at the same time, was this just a matter of you getting tired or getting inspired by a different style?
Sometimes it was like, oh, does this information need to be here? And that was a great freedom, because it's like, oh, no, this is going to be revealed in part three. Lowry is going to find this in a file, and the reader is going to again have to read every word because that's where the answer is. Yeah, I mean, sometimes it was also like the dead town parts, even though it was like a constant like marching drumbeat in my head, what the style and progressions were. Those were very meticulous to write, like very detail oriented. And so they took a lot of energy. And so I couldn't just like rush through them. So when I wanted a break from that, I would work on part two. And then at some point, like the Lowry stuff, I think I wrote in like three different goes very close together. So that didn't really impact the rest of the writing. But then part two, I would go to and I would write things out of sequence. Like I knew what the sequence would basically be, but I would write whatever I was in the mood to write. Like, oh, I want to write the scene between old Jim and the medic, this guy who was on the expedition in Dead Town, in a chapter called The Patriot, which is one of my favorite scenes just because this little like pot-bellied old man wearing a leather jacket comes up to him, and at first you're slightly sympathetic, but he has like zero morals or ethics to speak of, and the conversation is horrifying. But anyway, that's basically what I did, is you know, just write the thing that I'm most passionate about in the moment, you know.
Now, another thought I had as I was reading this was, you have just moved, I guess you've been there for a while in your new house, mm-hmm. where you've been really interested in, and you were interested in this beforehand, was rewilding, what you call mm-hmm. rewilding, which is just yeah. taking your land back to the way it had been before all these invasive plants and all these production mm-hmm. plants that were introduced. I'm wondering if you felt that perhaps this book in particular and the other books in the Southern Reach trilogy were a way of you rewilding your own writing.
That's a really good question. I mean, I guess that, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I love all the novels. They come to me different ways, but it is true that Annihilation came to me after kind of a reset. You know, I had changed agents. I was kind of adrift. You know, I'd had Finch do well, but it was still from an indie publisher. And, you know, I needed to do something in a different direction. I had just finished the Ambergris. There were no more Ambergris stories. That was my prior series. And so, you know, it was definitely like uncharted territory. The next point that occurred at, I think, was Dead Astronauts in 2019, because it was the first novel I wrote after the Annihilation movie came out. And I felt like the commercializing of that, even though it was a strange movie, but like all the apparatus and PR surrounding it had begun to colonize my imagination. I was very scared that I was going to change as a writer somehow. And so when Dead Astronauts came into my mind, which is like the most formally experimental, you know, kind of crazed narrative, I was like, I'm going to write this and it's going to clear that right out of my head. I didn't even know that was going to be published. Like I sent it to my editor. I was still surprised to this day that he was fine with it. But and I think Absolution is kind of similar, like because of the pandemic. Like I, you know, I had written Hummingbird Salamander really before the pandemic. You know, I was finishing little parts of it up, and that's why the pandemic appears in it. But I hadn't written anything since then, you know, and I had had all these stops and starts, things that may become novels in the future but need time. And I'd suffered some personal setbacks that, you know, I haven't really been public about, that were pretty devastating. And so, you know, I was, I think, looking for a fresh start to some degree. And, you know, it's just usually my subconscious just like saves me. It makes it impossible for me to write something that isn't personal. It either stops me or it starts me up again. And I think that in this case, it really started me up again.
Well, that's interesting about your subconscious. Do you think that you are writing novels even when you're not thinking about it? Or, I mean, for example, this novel, there was a lot of like cloud formation that I think went on mm-hmm, in your head. Mm-hmm. It was like seeding, yes. You were seeding the clouds.
Yeah,
but do you think there was something or is something happening, like even as we speak?
Well, actually, it's interesting because during the pandemic, I wrote a lot longhand just for myself. I thought, just kind of like isolated, not able to do events and things, and getting kind of depressed about everything. And so I was just writing for myself, and I looked at that stuff recently because I'm not sure, I wasn't sure what I was going to write next, and I realized that I had actually written a new series, and didn't realize it at the time that there were three novels that actually are in the same, they're the same thing. And I'd written like, and this is what's really kind of crazy is I don't remember, like I was like 45,000 words. I wrote 45,000 words of this novel, and it takes rereading it to remember I wrote it. So there's a couple of things. There's like really literally four, potentially four different novels, three in one series that may be the next thing. But that's just by way of saying that, I think my brain is constantly working in terms of story, and sometimes it just, I actually recently, it was really weird. I was writing, reading this novel I wasn't really happy with, and I actually stopped reading it, but the next morning I had to like write 50 pages of what I think the ending would have been if I'd liked the novel. I'm not going to tell you what the novel is, but so clearly my brain wants to write at this point again. So.
That's kind of interesting about when you say you write things and don't remember writing them. Do you think that that's your subconscious working, or do you think that that's your inner eraser working? I mean, it's
It's a,
important what
yeah.
we forget and toss out is really as important as what we keep.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, I think I sometimes think of like external and internal memory. Like a lot of times it's hard for me to keep in my head stuff that's in my email. I mean, dates and stuff, but like individual like emails that are personal correspondence and stuff, as opposed to like letters that I get in the mail. And yeah, so I mean, I don't know. Like at first I was like, am I getting Alzheimer's? But no, my memory is pretty much the same as it's always been. I do think that it's just like whatever I'm working on next supplants what's, my memory of what I worked on last. And sometimes, because I get up in the morning and I write before I'm fully awake on purpose, to not have an internal editor in my mind, I think that's also why, to some degree, because it is very organic. I'm writing it longhand. And I'm just like getting it all out on the page. I'm not worrying about whether it's perfect or not. And then I set it aside, so.
Do you retype your own handwriting?
I do, and that is something where I've lately had to be more careful because my handwriting is deteriorating a little bit. And I did have the disconcerting thing of like finding a whole page of absolution notes that I could not read at all, and no one I knew could read them either. I sent a photo of it to people I write letters to, and none of them could decipher it. And luckily, it wasn't important. But yeah, so I'm now a little more careful with the handwriting.
I just watched Acceptance last night after a while. I thought it was really quite good. Could you talk about other, I know some of your other works are in development. Where is that, and how does that seeing your works like essentially completely revised, which they have to be to go onto a screen, how does that influence what is churning in your brain as the next project?
One thing I would say is that I wanted to make sure that the Annihilation movie was not in my brain while writing Absolution. And thankfully, it's so completely different from Annihilation that it couldn't be. But I did have a cautionary tale in my head because this writer who did a Mario Puzo Godfather novel, as I recall, made the mistake of using things from both the movie and the books, irritating readers quite a bit because it didn't quite match up with either. But no, but the only thing that did stick with me is the albino alligator. I do remember an early conversation with the director where I told him that there had been no movie made with a white albino alligator that was any good. And he told me that this would be the first one. And to some degree, he's correct. But I still, in the back of my head, was like, okay, this is actually kind of a challenge, not even because of the movie, but because alligators are such a cliche in Florida. and in literature to some degree, but I was like, I want to write about a very unique alligator. And so in Absolution, you could say that the tyrant, this alligator who actually has kind of a symbiotic relationship with a with one of the characters, is the product of me thinking, I want to do something more kind of like awe-inspiring alligator-wise than what was in the movie. And as for other things that are being done, AMC just renewed the option on Born for the fifth time, and I can't really talk about it, but they have a very, very true to the book treatment, and I'm really hopeful that it will proceed. As for how it affects me, this option's been in place since before I wrote Strange Bird and Dead Astronauts, which are two of my strangest works. So clearly, it's had zero effect on me, because that's the additional material that AMC has to work with now if they want to use it for Born. So.
One of the things that I find most interesting about your work is the relationship of, horror to storytelling, in that I think that you use your storytelling abilities to create, I think, a really different kind of horror. It's not I guess what you would call a jump scare horror. It's a really effective creeping cosmic terror. And I think, it's, I guess, it's slightly reminiscent of a Lovecraft, but completely different. And I think far more successful. So talk about, just do you experience cosmic horror every day?
No, not at all. Except I would say that I just checked into a different hotel room because things are, even there's a lot of people who are still affected by the aftermath of the hurricane who have checked into places in Greenville, and I did get a sandwich through room service that to me was cosmic horror on a plate, but that's a totally different subject. I think. I came out of horror. I started out writing horror short stories, and the thing that that really taught me is that there's a certain amount of monotone that goes into doing uncanny fiction. If you can't modulate those kinds of effects, and if you can't get very visceral with them without being explicit, so to speak, which is to say, I don't like being gory, but I do want to make the reader actually feel the experience, and that may be uncomfortable. So I take a lot of notes on texture and things like that with regard to, and then use a lot of all four, five senses. Like sometimes I will literally kind of like not give you any kind of description from the five senses, like leading up into a visceral event on the page, and then overload it so that you can kind of like really feel it because of the absence before, which hopefully you haven't noticed. And there's a lot of that in Absolution because it just happened to be the kind of book where there were a lot of very disturbing tactile events occurring. And a lot of that was oddly keyed by, again, this aquarium in Panacea, where I walked into this room with these jars full of dead things from the deep sea, lit up with like these rave lights for some reason, like in all these different psychedelic colors. And something about that, like just the kind of beautifully sad way some of the creatures were like decomposing, even though they were in these preserving fluids, and the way some of them were floating and everything, I think really affected a lot of stuff in the novel. Because there's, in addition to just the general descriptions of dead things in jars in the novel, and you could say that the barrel scene qualifies as that as well, now that I think about it. Which is probably, this is the thing, we're talking about scenes where I can't tell you the further context, except say that I could sign the novel to people, personalize it, get in the barrel, but but yeah, so that's it creates contrast, and then that also brings up the subject of when I do that, I do tend to also want to have some dark humor in there as contrast. So it's all about like this modulation of not getting into a monotone situation.
Now, you've also written books about writing, and I'd like you to talk about just What inspires you to write about writing? Very helpful books for other writers of your genre or just people who want to write.
Yeah, I think that I wrote Book Life and Wonder Book for the same reason. I didn't think the book existed, and it was a book that I would have wanted when I was farther back in my career, earlier in my career. And one of those, Wonder Book, was simply that there was no general writing guide that I knew of that was comprehensive, that included examples from all kinds of literature, non-realistic as well as realistic. There were tons of writing, general writing books like Revising Fiction, which I love, which used Faulkner and other writers considered to be mimetic, even if they were fantastical. So sometimes Wonder Book is seen as a genre writer's book. It's not. It's a general writing book that just uses a wider range of examples. And then also, I had the opportunity to write a book in Wonder Book that replaced words with visual diagrams and art in a way that hadn't been done before. And so that was also good. It was like, if I was going to write something like that, it needed to be something that didn't exist. And then Book Life is really for up until like your second or third, your first or second book published. I think it's extremely valuable. And that didn't exist when I had my first book out, like listing like what all the publication steps are. Or, what are the kind of strategies that you can use to kind of preserve your creativity and still, do the things publicly you need to do for your career? And that kind of book in a very practical way didn't exist. And so that's why I wrote both those books.
Well, I remember early, much earlier in your career. I mean, you were a pioneer in self publicizing, and you did a really good job at in a way that was like really effective and impressive, as opposed to, here I am, aren't I great?
Well, I mean, I always early on thought, if I'm going to do this, it's going to be excruciating if there isn't some creative element to it. And so I think that that's really the idea of creative play and having fun while promoting your book, creating like actual valuable like art objects, so to speak, out of it. And that's kind of borne fruit on the other side then, because by the time Annihilation came out, it kind of like become this thing such that I was getting call and response back from the readers, doing fan art, doing all kinds of things in response. And so it's kind of taken on a life of its own where the readers actually do some of the promotion for me in a very fun, and enthusiastic way. And then the other thing is that early on, I realized, well, I write stuff that's fairly uncategorizable. Sometimes it repurposes certain kinds of things, so it's recognizable, but it does something different. I'm going to need to push my books myself in order to sell enough to have a career. I'm going to have to be better at this than if I fit into a neat category where there are always are already a lot of like ways for people to find my books, So.
The new novel by Jeff Vandermeer is Absolution. Thank you for joining me, Jeff. This has been fun.
Yeah, it has. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.